So we're talking to Ken Scott, the recording engineer, who's now living in Los Angeles.
I have done since 1976.
Really?
Yes.
And you went there to work?
Yeah, and plus the sunshine was nice back then. These days it's as boring as hell.
Yeah. But, do you like it there in Los Angeles?
No, we're moving.
You are?
Yeah.
Where are you going to go?
It's still up for grabs. It's looking like Nashville at the moment, just because of the music scene down there.
I was going to say, that's where the action right now is, in Nashville.
It seems to be.
Yeah.
I hear mixed reports. L.A. is terrible at the moment, and I've heard 50% of the people say that Nashville is as dead as L.A., and 50% of the people say, no, more and more people are moving here. It's great. You've got to come.
There are recording studios here that use tape.
Are there?
Yeah.
There are recording studios there.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Thing.
That's right. So let's just go back a bit. I'm not sure I want to go back to the Beatles right away. Well, let's go all the way back. All right, let's go all the way back. So I read the beginning of your book, and you talk about this, how you went to EMI, you applied for a job, and pretty soon you're there twiddling the knobs. And it doesn't, I don't understand it. I don't see, and you know, you said before in this session that I was in, that I watched, that, you know, it was God's will or something. But it went too fast in the book. I mean,
It went too fast in my life.
Well, we all have that problem.
I'm kind of deadly serious. I was at school. I wrote letters on a Friday. 9 days later, I was working at what became the most famous recording studio in the world. That doesn't happen in real life.
No, but it happened in your life, though.
Yes.
And what about... were you interested in sound? And was sound?
Oh, yeah, I knew what I wanted to do.
I
was 13.
Okay,
I got a tape recorder when I was Christmas when I was 12, and from then on it was recording all the latest recordings off the radio,
right.
But also doing radio plays with friends. They'd come over, we'd record them, which was a godsend for us because we go in with the tape recorder for our English lesson, and we got to play the radio plays we'd done rather than learning about nouns and pronouns and adverbs and all of that kind of thing. So it was great for everyone, and I was hooked on recording.
Okay, because I'm not sure that was clear in the book that you were really involved in.
Okay.
That it was important to you, and I didn't quite get the connection. But, okay, so you go to EMI, you're working in the tape section.
Tape library, yeah.
Okay. That's a clerical job, essentially.
Yeah,
see what you could do.
Yeah.
And then, pretty soon after that, you were cutting lacquers? I mean...
not pretty soon. It was the first move, which was within 6 months, was from the tape library to being an assistant engineer, button pusher, as we were called back then. Then I did that for... Okay, I've got to go.
Okay,
for a second.
Pause. Sorry. I understand. This reminded me of something. So you were the engineer on Jeff Beck's Truth.
I was.
And so you were at the board when Keith Moon knocked over a microphone during the recording of Beck's Bolero?
No, I didn't do Beck's Bolero. Because that was done as a single before. England was very much into the whole thing of you had to have at least a hit single, possibly a couple, before you could do an album.
Right.
And that was very much what happened. It was Jeff did... he did two. He did Hi Ho Silver Lining, and he did Beck's Bolero.
You heard that story, though? Do you know that story?
No, I don't. No, well, you know, do you know my... you haven't read the book yet. I don't know how far you've got. My Keith Moon story with Jeff. We were recording Old Man River.
Right.
Mooney came in to play Timps, and the session eventually finished at about 11 o'clock at night. Mooney had this Rolls Royce that had a PA system built into it, and he goes out, he's pulling out of the car park at Abbey Road, and this little old woman was walking her dog, and she happens to step in front of the Rolls Royce just as he's trying to come out. He immediately turns on the PA, and he's cursing and swearing at her in the most foul language you can possibly believe. And EMI has never been liked because... the studio hasn't been liked because it's in a posh neighborhood, a residential neighborhood.
Right.
The complaints they got after that, because it was loud, was unbelievable. And that lasted for about a week, and then all sort of calmed down a bit. But yeah, no, look, I think everyone has Keith Moon stories.
Right. Well, I don't, but now I have one, and you told it. So let's just go back. So you became a knob twiddler.
As little as possible.
But that's what you were doing. You went from being tape librarian to...
Tape library to second engineer to mastering, as it's called these days. It was cutting back then. And then on to engineering.
Okay, so when you were cutting, which is a very important job.
Yes.
Which in those days, it was really important because that's how everybody heard music.
It's still the same.
Well,
that's the final stage before people hear
right,
it.
But now they have CDs. They don't have to be. They don't.
Well,
have
no.
To
still,
cut.
You still have to go through a
mastering, but not cutting lax.
No, no.
So in cutting, when you cut lax with some of the Beatle albums, right?
No, I didn't.
You didn't.
No.
Oh darn. Because
sorry, no. That was the masters for Beatles albums were always done by a gentleman by the name of Harry Moss.
Okay, for all of them.
As far as I know,
now,
he did all of them.
Okay, but you cut other records.
Yeah.
Now, when you cut records, were you told to limit the amount of bass on the records?
I was never given that instruction.
Because the amount of bass on these Beatle reissues, compared to the original records,
yes.
is, I mean, they pumped the bass way up.
I know.
Did you listen to the record vinyl version or just
no,
the CD version?
No, just the look. I heard compression on some of the stuff that
yes.
I did that I'll swear I didn't do on the original. But I'm close friends with Alan Rouse, who was the guy at Abbey Road who was in charge of all of that.
Right.
And he swears to me that they did virtually nothing.
I heard from Sean McGee that they did compress. Not a lot, but they did compress to make it more modern. And
I've always been a proponent that the mono should be out there, because for so long it wasn't. Because the mono was the only thing that the Beatles okayed up until the White Album.
Right.
The mono was the only that was the standard for the Beatles. The stereos they never heard.
Right, because that's what kids. Everybody was hearing mono on the radio, and most kids had mono record players.
Yes, right? And that's why. It was so important for the Beatles. They started to get more involved in the stereo during the White Album, and I got it straight from the horse's mouth. We mixed the mono of Helter Skelter. We were mixing the stereo of Helter Skelter. Paul was by the side of me. I'm fading out at the end, exactly the same as the mono. Come down, and then he says, "Okay, now fade it back up again." I said, what? He said, start fading it back up again. So I faded it back up again, and then we get to the famous ending and everything. He said,
right.
Okay, put it down. I pulled it down. I said, what the fuck was that all about? And he said, well, we've started to get lots of fan mail telling us the differences between mono and stereo. So we figured if we actually make the stereo different from the mono, we might sell twice as many albums.
So I have the mono. On the mono, the Helter Skelter just doesn't fade.
Yeah. Just fades down.
I don't remember that. But there's a lot of differences between the mono and the stereo.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we never used to bother about the stereo. We didn't take notes when we did mixes or anything like that. And so, frequently, they would change the speed of the tape machine for a track, because they eventually decided it should be slightly faster, it should be slightly slower. Now, we never made a note as to how much we changed it. And so we'd do the mix. Mono mix and it'd be fine. Then a couple of weeks later, when they're not around, oh, we're doing a stereo mix. No one can remember how much we did it. We didn't play it back with the mono
right.
to match it up. We just, oh yeah, that'll do kind of thing. And it was just thrown together.
And they sped it up to make it jump more, to make it more lively.
Yeah, sometimes.
Because that happened on Tommy.
Yeah.
As it turns out, because I was involved with the reissue of that, and they had me bring original British pressings to LA, and they put the tape up. And we started tracking it along, and all of a sudden, it was off.
Okay.
And then we sped it up to match.
Okay. Well, and with Missing Persons, I brought them up earlier about Tron. With Missing Persons, we had done some demos, which were eventually used for the album. without touching them, the mixes and everything. And we had had cassettes that were made at the studio that we'd been listening to and came to master. And suddenly the master tape, master mix, was slower. Their cassette machine had been the studio's cassette machine had been running slow, so when we played it on ours, it was always faster.
Right.
So suddenly, oh no, we can't stand it, it's too slow, so we had to speed up for mastering,
funny.
Which that kind of thing happens all the time, or it used to happen all the time.
Yeah, now it doesn't happen as much. But so if you worked at Abbey Road, you did all these recordings with the Beatles, which is in the book. I don't know how much you want to talk about that. You could talk about that forever, probably. So then, how did you move from there to working with other people outside of there?
I moved to Trident. I got into a huge row with the new manager of Abbey Road Studios in the midst of the White Album. And as soon as we finished the White Album, the last day was... It was over 24 hours, and I was exhausted. We'd been working nonstop.
Can you work well if you've been up?
Well, that was putting it together in the running order. It was all of that kind of thing. So
yeah.
So there were some mixes earlier on, but it was a question we had to do it because George was flying to LA that day, and he had to take the masters because. Normally, the Beatles didn't have any kind of time set.
Right.
This was the first issue on Apple.
Their own label.
Right, right. So, we've got to get it on time. Suddenly,
gotcha.
there's this thing. So we had to get it finished so that he could bring it over to Capitol.
Now, did he take the actual masters or a copy?
No, copy.
Copy.
And so I immediately took 2 weeks off. Came back, and the manager, who I'd had a row with halfway through the White Album, gave me this project that he had set up for me to fail, basically. I failed. Yeah.
How could you? But you were so successful up to that point. How could you?
Well, this was a stupid thing. He was a classical engineer that he hated anything to do with pop.
Okay.
And I had sided with the Beatles as opposed to the studio. On something which he didn't like. I had to hell with anyone else. You side with the studio. So anyway, I failed this test that he'd basically set up. He fired me instantly.
Wow.
Stupid timing. I had the number one album throughout the world at that point
as an
engineer.
Yeah.
You don't fire someone at that point.
Yeah.
So I went to the head of EMI Records, told him the story, and he said, that's stupid, you're not fired. And the manager... had to apologize to me in front of the entire staff at the studio.
That was a pretty stupid thing they did.
I know, absolutely ridiculous. But I'd reached that point. I knew that the target was on my back.
Right.
He wanted me out. He would eventually find a way of getting me out. So I just started to look around. And I was working with Gus Dudgeon, Elton's eventual producer.
Sure.
And he'd worked at various outside studios, and I said, where would you suggest? And he said, well, how about Trident? Well, I'd had dealings with Trident. I'd gone down there for Hey Jude, when Hey Jude was recorded,
right.
And listened to it then. And I said, okay, and I called him up, and we set up a meeting, and I started there. And so that's how I started to work with other people outside of the EMI.
For 1 second, because I got to the part of your book where you had recorded Hey Jude at that studio, and they had new speakers that you didn't mention the brand of, and then you took the tapes back to Abbey Road and played them. And
I didn't do the recording. Barry Sheffield, one of the owners of the studio, did, because engineers at Abbey Road weren't allowed to go to other studios.
But you were involved in the mix of it or something?
No, I went, I broke the rules, and I went down to listen to it. And I sat in front of the mixing desk there, the sound techniques board, and the speakers were Lockwood cabinets with Tannoy, I think, golds. But they could have...
Bernie Grundman still uses those golds.
Yeah, okay. And I sat down and they played it, and it was absolutely phenomenal. I'd never heard anything like it. It was louder than I'd heard anything. It was cleaner. The high end was just amazing.
Because you were using what back at Abbey Road? Voice in the theaters?
Yeah. These outtakes that were terrible. Yeah. And
which is amazing because the recordings sound so great.
But that's the why. That's why. We had to struggle so hard to make it sound good on those speakers.
Yeah.
If it sounded good on those speakers, it would sound good anywhere.
Right.
Which was the complete opposite of Trident. Trident's room had been set up. It was total hype.
Yeah.
It was set up so that almost anything would sound really good in there.
And so you can't, you have no basis of what you're...
No, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So then when the tapes get back to Abbey Road, I go up, they're cutting playback outtakes off them, I go up and I listen, and it sounds like this. There's absolutely no high end on it whatsoever. So I go down, and the first one that comes in is George Martin. And I know it wasn't like this, but this is just the way I choose to remember it. He said, "Have you heard it?" I said, "Oh, I went down to Trident and heard it. It was great." And he said, "Yeah, but have you heard it here?" I said, I said, "Well, yes, I heard it here." And he said, "And what do you think?" "Well, it's not very good. There's no high end on it whatsoever." John walks in. George's, the way I choose to remember it, and I know it wasn't like this, but George says, "Ken thinks it sounds like shit." And so John just looks at me. Then someone else comes in. Eventually, all of them are there, and they've all gone down to the studio, and I'm sitting behind the board, and I see them looking up every now and again. And it was that whole thing of if looks could kill. I was sinking lower and lower in the chair.
But you didn't record it.
No, no.
But you're still responsible.
I'm saying it sounds terrible.
Right.
They don't want to hear that.
Right.
They want to hear it sounds great.
But they know what sounds good,
but they hadn't heard it at that point.
Oh, okay. Then
so what happened, they all come stomping up the stairs, and George says, "Okay, let's hear it." So I send the second engineer up, he picks it up, brings the tape down, plays it, and they all agree. It did sound bad. So we then spent like 5 hours correcting it, and that's what you finally hear.
Now, how do you correct it? You've got a two-track master tape?
Well, just EQ.
We
had to just try and fix it.
Yeah.
Because the problem was, it was 8-track.
Right.
The reason they went to Trident was to try 8-track.
Oh, you don't have 8-track.
And EMI didn't have 8-track, so we couldn't remix it. We had to just take the mix that had been done and doctor it.
Because that recording, the cymbals on that recording, really stick out now. I mean,
that was the way we EQ'd it.
But it sounds good.
Well, it's okay.
Yeah,
So
now, at Trident, what were your first projects there?
The earliest I remember was mixing Give Peace a Chance. John and Yoko came in, and they'd recorded it in Canada, and we mixed it.
Yeah. Is that where Hunky Dory got recorded?
Yeah.
Why does that record say remixed by Ken?
That's what we used to call it, because when you're working, like, going from 4-track, you mix going on to, like, track one will be the rhythm section. It's the bass, drums, maybe a couple of guitars.
Right.
So you're mixing then. So when you take it from 4-track down to stereo, you're remixing. And 8-track is the same. So it's only today where you can put everything on its own track.
Right.
That you're not mixing at the recording stage, so you mix at the mix stage.
I see why.
Whereas back then, it was we were mixing at the recording stage and then remixing.
Okay. How many tracks were on that Hunky Dory album?
I don't have proof of this. My recollection is we started off 8-track. Some of the tracks were 8-track and some of them were 16.
Yeah.
That's my recollection.
Good sounding recording. Very good sounding recording. And
it worked.
And Ziggy was how many tracks?
16. Yeah, 16.
So was David Bowie a different person between those two records?
No. There was 3 weeks between them. 3-4 weeks between them.
Really?
Yes.
I had no idea.
He was being funded by his management company for recording, because he still didn't have a deal at that point.
Right.
So we did Hunky Dory. I saw him a couple of weeks after finishing Hunky Dory. He said, we're going to record another album. I said, what are you talking about? Hunky Dory isn't even out yet. He said, my management company wants another album. We're just about to sign a record deal, but we want to have something more to play them. And we want to have something just on the shelf so that we can go out with it immediately.
And where did how did he write? He wrote all that in between?
He had some of it already.
Yeah.
Because I had recorded a couple of the songs before with a friend of his, whose name escapes me at the moment, but he eventually finished up being one of his clothes designers.
Uh-huh. And since the records are so different, the vibe
are
is so
they?
Different.
Yeah. You see, in overall content, I agree. Obviously, Hunky is slightly more...
It's more acoustic.
It's more acoustic. But then you've got something like Queen Bitch.
Right.
Which could have fitted perfectly on Ziggy.
But that's the odd song.
But then you take It Ain't Easy, which is on Ziggy,
right.
Which was recorded for Hunky Dory. And it just wasn't used on that. And we just put it on...
Where did he get that? I know that Ron Davies wrote that song. Yes. It was a very obscure... Yeah. Where did he get that from?
I have no idea, but he always did one cover song.
Yeah. Yeah, but I see how Queen Bitch could have been on the other.
That was so close. It was there was very little difference. I changed the drum sound slightly from a technical aspect. I changed the drum sound slightly.
But you didn't have a big piano.
There's something that only recently I've come to realize with regard to David, how he used piano to change his style. You've got Hunky Dory with Rick Wakeman, which is more classically oriented.
Right.
Then you move on to Ziggy, which was David and Ronno playing, and it's very simplistic.
What's the name?
On Ziggy, it was Ronno, Mick Ronson.
Oh, Mick Ronson, yeah.
Yeah, Mick Ronson and David playing piano. And they weren't great pianists,
right.
So it's very simple.
Rudimentary, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then you move into Without Insane with Garson.
Right.
And
it's flowery. It's completely
flowery. Aladdin Sane, I wouldn't call flowery. It's out there. It's totally different. It's harder edged, just because that avant-garde piano thing, it puts you on edge.
Yeah.
And it's that's the way David used piano. It was fascinating. And to me, looking back on it.
So in the studio, when those two, for the listener, Ziggy Stardust comes across as a much different, the vibe is different.
Yeah.
Was the situation in the studio any different?
No. I think one of the reasons that Ziggy works so well is because it was done so quickly. There's normally that thing, we would spend 2 weeks recording an album back then. Then you wouldn't see the artist for 5.5 months, and then we'd spend another 2 weeks doing the next one.
Right.
And within that second 2 weeks, you'd have to relearn the artist, you'd have to form a relationship again, and get back on the same page. Whereas because we'd just done Hunky, and then into Ziggy, it was still the same team. We'd learnt each other.
So we
hadn't forgotten. So it just worked immediately off the bat.
And you were as much a producer there as an engineer.
Oh yeah, that was the whole thing. I was assistant.
Yeah.
That's
a whole different job.
Yeah.
Right. Engineer is technical, but producer is.
It's considered that way. But one of the things that got me into production was that whole thing. I always use. I'm sure it's not politically correct, but I always use this example. As an engineer, you eventually go through the thing of you're recording a track. You've got the producer sitting next to you, and you turn to the producer and you said, "You know what this needs? In the second chorus, it needs a 70 lesbian hummers." And he sort of looks at you and he pushes the button, and he says, "Why don't we try 70 lesbian hummers on the second chorus?"
That's a producer who doesn't have a vision of what.
It's. Believe me, this happened a lot. It wasn't just one producer. And
so, what did the producer do?
Well, hang on. It's that thing. You then try the 70 lesbian hummers,
right.
And if it works, then the producer takes all the credit.
Of course.
Yeah, and if it didn't, it's, oh, well, that was only Ken's idea anyway.
That's
so
life, okay. But that's life and everything.
I know, but you eventually, as an engineer, get fed up with it. And
right.
I got fed up with it,
right.
As did Roy Thomas Baker at exactly the same
right.
time, as did Robin Jeffrey Cable at exactly the same time.
Right.
All three of us, the three main engineers at Trident, all started to feel exactly the same way at the same time. And we all wanted to move into production. I was lucky enough that I happened to, or blessed, whatever you want to call it. I was working with David recording some of the songs from Ziggy with this friend of his. And during one of the break, and David was producing, he wasn't the artist. I happened to say to David during one of the breaks that I wanted to move into production. And he said, I've just signed a new management deal. They want to put me into the studio to record an album. I was going to produce it myself. I don't know if I'm capable of doing it. Will you co-produce it with me? Sure. That was hunky-dory.
Did you see him becoming as big a star as he
at that point? At yeah. that exact point? No, I didn't. Absolutely yeah. not. I'd done two albums with him before as an engineer.
What did you
Space Oddity.
Oh, you did?
I did most of the album. I didn't do Space Oddity. Barry Sheffield did that.
Right.
But most of the album I did, and I did overdubs and mixed it. Yes.
The sound of that gourd.
Oh, I can't remember.
it's insanely good.
Amazing. Yeah. I can't remember if I recorded it or not, but yeah. I certainly mixed it.
It's one of those gourds where the stick goes against it. It's like
yeah.
It's okay. Insanely good. I didn't know you did that.
Yeah. So I'd worked on those, so I knew David, and.
And those were not big hit albums.
Absolutely
they were very
not.
Esoteric.
But that's the thing. David took a long time off.
Yeah.
And I saw him as, he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
He's obviously got a certain amount of talent, but superstar? Never.
And then?
Yeah, right. So when I had been, as a second engineer, as an assistant engineer, and as an engineer, I'd been dropped into the deep end, because both times it was with the biggest band in the world. So if I messed up, everyone would hear it.
Right.
Suddenly I thought, okay, I'm moving into production. Here's this guy that no one's ever going to really hear. Perfect. I can learn my gig without anyone hearing it. Then David Angie and his publisher, Bob Grace, came over to the house one evening to go through the material for Hunky Dory. And he's playing these demos, and suddenly it's a whole different thing. Suddenly it's, my God, this guy really is talented. This could be incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, God, here we go again.
Well, good, though.
I know, but
and
it's
and
terrifying.
And Hunky was not a big hit when it first came out,
no,
either.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
But Ziggy took off.
Yeah, I think Tony... My feet... Look, there are two things about Ziggy. Number one was the Top of the Pop Starman thing.
Right.
Which helped. But I also firmly believe, I have no proof of it, but I just believe that Tony DeFries bought it into the charts, because that happened a lot in England
at
that point.
I was on that tour covering it for a magazine. So I was on the plane with them. I saw the shows in Chicago.
Now, which
Detroit,
this is America. I'm thinking
and
of England.
At Carnegie Hall, it was the response of the audience was it was messianic. It was a religious experience for the audience.
New York.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
How was it down south?
Well, I didn't go down south.
Oh, okay. I know
Boston,
it was very different.
New York, Chicago, Detroit, and Philadelphia.
How was Detroit?
I sat next to Epoch, and it was fantastic. The audience went crazy. They loved it.
How big was the audience?
A couple thousand. Like the Tower Theater size.
Okay, because I know there were some gigs that it was almost empty.
Yeah, I didn't go to those.
Okay.
I'm sure it was a regional thing,
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
It could not have been. It wasn't Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know?
Mm.
So that's all very exciting as far as I'm concerned. And you're doing this without knowing how big this is going to be.
Of course, but you never do.
Yeah.
Even with the Beatles, doing the White Album.
But you know how big that... that was big already.
No, you knew it was big, but... As an example, they were coming off of Sgt. Pepper, and typically of the Beatles, they wanted everything to be different the next time round,
right.
kind of thing. and they didn't want to do another. Well, maybe Paul did, but no one else. At times, yes. It's artistic temperament. I've done albums that have taken 2 weeks, and at some point during that, the artistic temperament will come out, and guess what? There'll be an argument. When you spend 6 months, which we did on the White Album, that's going to happen more than once. But the overall feeling on the album was amazing. It was, we had a blast. I interviewed Chris Thomas primarily for the book. Chris was George Martin's assistant, right. And he went on to produce Sex Pistols, Pretenders, right. Procol Harum, a whole bunch of things.
You recorded in Salty Dog?
I recorded Salty Dog, yeah. But
okay, I'm interrupting you, so.
Okay. But I spoke to Chris, and I did the typical thing that an interviewer does. At the end of the interview, I said, "Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to say?"
Right.
And he said, "Please make sure that people know we had a blast recording the White Album. They were fun. They weren't always arguing. It was great."
So that's all a big story.
Yeah.
Oh, so in Ziggy Stardust, one song, there's a phone rings at the end and someone's talking.
Yes.
What was that all about?
I give talks at universities where I play exactly what it is.
Yeah.
What it was... One of the things...
Life on Mars? Yes, it is. Yeah.
What I emphasize in my talks, because they're primarily for universities, I preach making decisions, because that's something that seems to be lacking from the modern-day lifestyle. especially in the studio. I can't tell you how many times I've seen and or heard of... someone getting in a recording and they come to the guitar solo and there are 99 different guitar solos because no one could make a bloody decision as to which one it should be.
Right.
And they waste so much time trying to sort it out. So part of making decisions is knowing what take's going to be the master.
Right.
So what I used to do, if it wasn't the master, I'd go back and re-record over it. Now, what happened on this one occasion, we were recording it, it was a really good take. But then right in the middle, there was a bathroom off of the actual studio at Trident, and there was a public phone box in there, right, for session musicians to use. No one knew the number. The number wasn't written on it or anything like that. Someone called in. It was a wrong number. And in the middle of this take... in the middle of this take of Life on Mars, this phone rang. We picked it up on the mics, and so I had to stop it. And Mick Ronson is cursing and swearing, "Oh, it was so good," and all of that. So I went back. That wasn't the one. We started to record. Now, whether they played it faster or they just started to play it sooner, we get the master take. Okay, we're overdubbing. We come to the orchestra. And at the end of it, the orchestra is just holding.
Right.
And then suddenly we have this piano we hadn't realized before. This piano suddenly comes in.
Yeah.
And this drum fill. And it's, oh my God, that's great. And then we suddenly hear Mick cursing. But we can't use that part. But we loved it so much. We just used part of it coming in. And then I had to fade it out fast before the swearing. But... That's basically what the phone was doing. Yeah, it was pure accident. Someone calling
and
in with the wrong number.
It just seems to take.
We enjoyed it.
Now the next. Okay, so Lover's Story, is that what's the name of this? Kooks.
Yeah.
The beginning of that. It's like the EQ is really strange on that. The guitar sounds like it's.
I put something. I can't remember what it was through a ring modulator.
Yeah, it's
which
very
is what does it.
Yeah.
Kind of,
yeah, yeah. What made you do that?
I've no idea.
But it was
instinct.
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah.
But that's what it always was.
Yeah.
You're experimenting. You're young. You're trying things.
So now, if you had your druthers, would you still be recording on tape, analog?
I still do when I can. I will say one thing. I will record on tape and then put it across into Pro Tools because I'm not one of these people that it has to be one thing or the other. I think they both have their good points.
Yeah.
And we have to use the best points of both.
Okay. But purely digital recordings, I can't.
It's getting better. It's still not perfect. But ultimately, as a professional in the studio, you have to remember, it's going to go down to a CD.
Well, not always. Now it goes back to everything's coming out on vinyl again. Everything.
Not everything, but... No, I know. It's starting to now. It definitely is.
I mean, I was at a demonstration where they played 96 24 files, 192 24-bit files, and then they played an analog tape transferred to DSD and played that. And it just sounded... It was the first recording that really made space.
You know what?
What?
I was blown away. 2 days ago, I was talking to my 24-year-old stepson. We were talking about recording, and basically this conversation. And he said how he went to a rave once. He always used he enjoyed going to raves for a while. And he said one day he walked in, and the sound was atrocious. He thought, what's going on? And he checked, and he found out they were using CDs as opposed to vinyl.
Right.
And he was just raving the difference between vinyl and...
Yes.
It was, yes. No, yes. Look, but you have to remember the time when we moved over to CD.
I remember it. It had to happen. It was the worst thing that ever happened in the history of the universe.
It had to happen because vinyl, we were using it in such vast quantities.
I know.
Record companies were just...
I know.
Any returns they throw back in, vinyl quality was getting worse and worse and worse.
I know. But
and so something had to come in to bridge the gap.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the technology when it first came in wasn't good enough.
No.
But it's all there was.
Yes, I went to the AES when they introduced the CD at the St. Bonaventure Hotel, and they played Roxy Music's Avalon, which is a wonderful recording.
Yeah.
And they had it on a CD. I had the German press, the American press, I had the Bulgarian press. And I had it, and I knew what that record sounded like. And it was horrible. And I said to myself, okay, when this song is over, everybody's going to say, it sounds terrible, but it's a great technology, it's going to get better. But instead, they said, did you hear that? It's the greatest thing I ever heard. And that's when I knew this was going to get really bad quickly. And it did. It got really bad. And what your godson said is right. And this generation is discovering that.
Stepson, not godson.
They're discovering that.
I know, which is great.
When they hear a record, it's like high-definition television for the first time.
But that's why... You know Colleen?
Sure, yeah.
Right, that's how we got together.
That's right.
And her whole concept of classic album Sundays, that kind of thing is the sort of thing that's going to turn people around.
That's right.
It's going to turn music around, because one of the things that has occurred, music has been devalued.
That's
recordings
right.
have been
yes,
devalued.
Yes, exactly.
And there are so many reasons why. One of the things that I go all out on is the fact that radio has become so genre-oriented. If a kid is interested in heavy metal, they'll just go to a station and they'll listen to nothing but heavy
metal.
Right. Or reggae, or punk, or rap, whatever.
Right.
So when it comes to the artistic side of recordings, one of the greatest things of David Bowie was his ability to pull from different sources, pull them all together and make them his heart. Make them his own.
Right, Jacques Brel had all
the Sono or Munoz Daydream was taken from the B-side of Alley Oop.
Is that true?
Yes. It's a Barrett on the B-side, Show No Enough About Love.
Which Alley Oop, the original? Because there were two.
It's apparently the original.
Oh, good.
Because who produced it? Kim?
I can't remember. There were two Alley Oops.
Okay.
I forgot the names of the groups that did them, but I used to know them.
Oh, no, it was the Hollywood Argyles.
Yes.
It was the B-side of the Hollywood Argyles.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And Show No Enough About Love. And one of the main lines through it is done by a baritone doubled an octave or a couple of octaves above by a flute. And David loved that. And so when it came to the solo of Munoz Daydream, we did a baritone and a recorder. In exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And he would pull things from all these different sources. Yeah. These days, the only thing they have to pull from, because they've only listened to one genre of music, is earlier versions of that genre.
Right.
So it's just regurgitating what's gone before. It's not bringing in new things to make it different.
You know what kids? Now, you know what kids are doing that? Kids that go trolling in the bottom of used record stores for 50-cent records,
sure,
and
sure.
They pull out. I know a guy who's now right. He was nominated for an Academy Award for an Oscar for his song that he did. He's a really smart guy named Josh Ralph, and that's how he got started.
Yeah.
He writes the songs, he produces it, and he's a good producer, and he's a good engineer, too. And he learned it from pulling the dollar records out and buying
sure.
just crates of them, just playing the records and playing the records.
Yeah, the problem is trying to find the stores that sell those.
Well, this is happening again.
Yeah, slowly but
Amoeba.
Surely.
You've been to
no, I know.
Oh
no, I agree. But they're few and far between.
Yes.
There aren't enough of them.
That's true.
And it will come back again, slowly. My feeling that the future for music is internet radio. First off, we have to get the politicians to make it a level playing field.
Right.
It can't be that internet radio has to pay both writers, producers, artists, record companies,
right.
whereas terrestrial only has to pay the writers.
Right.
That's totally unfair.
Right.
We have to level the playing field.
Right.
Then I see internet radio going more like the 60s and 70s, where it's personality-driven DJs.
Right.
You get to know a DJ, and they bring you into new music that you've never heard
That's
before.
That's what I did. I was in Boston on the radio in
okay.
the 70s. I had the all-night shift. I could play whatever I want.
What radio station?
BCN.
Okay.
And so there was a wall of
yes.
records.
Yes.
And I had to play whatever I want.
Yes.
Put something on and say,
yes.
what does that remind me of? Boom, boom, boom. And that's how.
And that's what we need to get
I know.
Back to.
Well, of course we do.
But until it's a level playing field, that won't happen.
And sound, how is sound going to get better? The sound is just...
I think when people start to get back into the music, because it's... Just music is so... It bothers me talking about the Beatles, about Bowie, these days, 40, 50 years late. We should be talking about today's music, but there is so little to talk about today's music.
There's some good things, like, you know, Ray LaMontagne, you know...
There are things.
There's good things.
There are things.
But not a lot.
No.
And they're underground.
Yes.
What's played on the radio is... It's
unlistable. It's Clear Channel.
Yeah, it's just terrible.
I know.
But it's going to get better. I'm very optimistic.
So am I.
Yeah,
look, I'm a firm believer that talent will win out.
Yep.
First and foremost, we have to kill off major labels.
Yep. And people have to relate to music by sitting and listening to it,
yes.
not having it on in the background
while
they do other
yeah,
things.
Yeah, I know, but then... If you take what major labels have done with albums, it will be 2-3 singles and then the rest is crap.
Right.
They don't care. Then, as long as it's that, people aren't going to be interested in an album.
And they
we
buy
need
singles,
to get
that's
back.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
we
right.
we need to get back to that whole thing of an album is a totally separate thing and it needs to it will take you on a journey.
Right.
You'll start off here,
right.
you'll suddenly go to the right, you'll suddenly go to the left. And it's
there's
a complete
some of that.
Thing.
There is some of that now.
Of course, there's some.
And those
it's
people are
not
putting
reaching
it out,
the majority.
Putting, no, it's not. And those people are putting it out on vinyl, too.
Yeah.
Which
okay,
is
sure.
You know, six songs on a side is fine. That's
yes.
enough. And then turn it over.
Oh, I think that's the best. I almost don't like the whole thing of a CD because there's no breathing space.
Right. And there's no ebb and flow, and it goes, it ends,
yes.
the side ends, and then
yes.
you turn it over, and then it
yes.
starts, picks up again.
Which is one of the great things about what Colleen's doing with,
that's right.
with
it is great.
Classic Album Sundays.
All
it's
these
great.
People. You know, her doing her thing, guys doing reissues the right way,
yeah.
and talking about
well,
it.
With Ziggy, the reissue of that was the first time I was brought in, really, on a reissue. What would you suggest?
Yes, you should
and
it
my, of course.
It sounded great. The vinyl sounded great.
Well,
it.
My suggestion was go back to Ray Staff, who was the
yes.
original mastering
yes.
engineer, who still has the same... feeling from back then as
yes.
opposed to we have to compress the hell out of it
right.
to make it modern.
Exactly.
And he did it exactly the way it was back then.
Right.
And it's great.
It's great.
He's done Land Insane. He's done...
That's Pine not out yet, though, is it?
No, it's coming out
yeah.
really soon.
Did he do Station to Station? He didn't do that.
No. But he might, if there's a reissue, he might do that.
Yeah.
Just because
it was reissued in a box set with all the stuff. And
everything's been... with David, everything's been reissued a million times.
Well, what he needs to do, but, he needs to do Heroes of the Lodger... and Low in a 3-LP box set with a big long essay about his Berlin recordings and what because those were you didn't do those but
yeah.
those were amazing
those
records.
Me,
yeah those were amazing records.
But well you know about the Classic Album Sunday in New York that we're doing at the end of the month.
The only one I know is the one I'm involved with at the Hi-Fi show next week. That's the only one.
Oh, no, there's one beginning of next month, I think it is. We're doing in New York. It's a Bowie Sunday, and I'm going to be doing it. I'm going to be talking about the recording and giving examples and that, and then playing Ziggy all the way through,
then awesome.
A Q&A. Then it's Tony Visconti talking about recording Heroes,
wow.
Playing all of Heroes, and then a Q&A. And then Nile Rodgers talking about the recording of Let's Dance.
Wow.
Play Let's Dance, then doing
and
a Q&A.
Where's she doing it? The place in Brooklyn?
I can't remember where it's being done.
Oh, I have to go to that if I'm around.
Yeah.
I have a lot of traveling next month, but if I'm around, I want to go to that.
Okay, I'm seeing her on Monday, so I will tell her you want to
go.
So
you're going to in New York? You're going to be here?
That's in New York,
yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you're going to be in New York on Monday.
Yeah. No, I'll be in Boston on Monday.
Oh, you're going to Berkeley, that's right.
Yes,
yeah.
And she's up there doing a Classic Album
right.
Sunday. On Sunday, it's just one of those weird things.
Yeah.
She's going to be there doing one thing on Sunday. She's still going to be there on Monday, so I said, you need to see one of my talks. Come by to Berkeley on Monday morning, and she's coming by specifically.
That's
so
great. Yeah, she's doing a great. It's a great thing that she's doing.
I know.
Doing.
It's amazing.
So, what have you done lately for money?
Pushed the book, and worked on a software package, a drum sample package called Epic Drums.
But if you had your druthers, you'd be back in the studio
absolutely
recording.
I can't. It's That's the bane of my life. I need to get back into the studio.
Yeah.
It's my passion. It's my love. Other than my wife, of course.
That's a whole different story.
Yeah. Right. But no, I've done a little bit. I did a couple of tracks with a band I really like called Fallen Riviera, a pop band.
Yeah.
I did the interesting one for me. I did a masterclass at a university in LA, Loyola Marymount. And they brought in a band from Seattle called Down North.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know anything about the band at all. I hadn't heard anything. And I was scared about the whole session. We hit it off. They are amazing. We're trying to get funding at the moment to record an album with them. They're very
do a Kickstarter project.
Well, there's that. But from Seattle, there's so much computer money in Seattle.
Yeah, that's right.
They think they can get the funding.
Yeah. I was just there doing an in-store appearance myself
okay.
in Seattle, and it's a big music town.
Yes,
great.
Absolutely. But it's such an interesting thing. It's the way I describe it is if Michael Jackson recorded with all of Van Halen as opposed to just Eddie.
Right.
Because the group, musically, it's very rock and roll. The singer is total Michael Jackson Prince.
Really?
Oh, he's got every move down. He's incredible.
Wow.
And it just the combination of the rock and roll with that vocal is, I haven't heard anything quite like it before. So it's great.
So how do you listen to music at home? Do you have a decent stereo to listen to music?
Not particularly. It's the only thing, and I've had it for years, are the speakers. When Apple first set up, were first setting up their studio, the first thing they did was a mastering room, and they got these speakers made by a company called Radford that were more they were known for their amps more than their speakers,
right.
But they came out with these speakers which Apple bought, and they loved the speakers, but they just couldn't get them loud enough for a mastering room. I bought the speakers off of them. I'm still using exactly the same speakers. They've never been reconed, nothing. They're still perfect. They're still great. I use those and basically Sony gear.
And you have a turntable?
No, I don't.
Ugh.
I know, it's disgusting.
You have your old records?
I've got not many of them. I've moved too many times and divorce and all of that kind of thing. It kind of messes up.
I won't publish that part of it.
No, that's fine. That's fine. She's okay. Already over hitting the roof about the book, so.
Yeah. Okay, well, this was great. I could talk with you for hours and hours and hours and ask you a million more questions.